Stormer at thedailystormer.com.
Adolf Hitler's 1941 declaration of war against the Soviet Union. People of Germany, National Socialists, after months of grave care, throughout which I was constrained to silence, the hour has now come in which I can at last speak frankly. When on the 3rd of September 1939, the German Reich received Britain's declaration of war, this was a further repetition of Britain's earlier attempts to frustrate at the very outset any plan of consolidation and therefore of progress in Europe by a war directed against whatever state was the most powerful on the continent at the time. Thus it was that Britain ruined Spain at one time in many wars. That was how she waged her wars on Holland. Thus she subsequently fought France with the help of the whole of Europe. And thus, at the beginning of the century, she commenced the encirclement of the German Reich of that time, and in 1914, the Great War. Only through internal dissension did Germany succumb in 1918, and the consequences were terrible. After they had declared, as true hypocrites of course, that they had only fought the Kaiser and his regime, they set about the systematic destruction of Germany as soon as the German army had laid down its arms. While the prophecies of a French statesman that there were 20 million Germans too many, that this number would have to be exterminated by hunger, disease or emigration, were apparently being fulfilled to the letter. The National Socialist movement began its work of unifying the German people and preparing for the resurrection of the Reich. Our people rose again from distress, misery and shame, and their recovery bore every sign of internal renaissance. Britain, especially, was not in any way affected or threatened thereby. Nevertheless, the new policy of the encirclement of Germany, born as it was of hatred, recommenced immediately. Internally and externally, there resulted that plot so familiar to all of us between the Jews and the Democrats, Bolsheviks and reactionaries, with the sole aim of preventing the establishment of the new German National People's State, of plunging the Reich once more into powerlessness and misery. Apart from us, the hatred of this international conspiracy was directed against those peoples which, not favoured by fortune, were obliged to earn their daily bread in the hardest of struggles for existence. Above all, the right of Italy and Japan to share in the goods of this world was contested, just as much as that of Germany. In fact, it was formally denied. The coalition of these nations was, therefore, only an act of self-protection in the face of the threat of an egotistic world combination of wealth and power. As early as 1936, Mr. Churchill, according to the statements of the American General Wood, before a committee of the American House of Representatives, declared that Germany was once more becoming too powerful and would therefore have to be destroyed. In the summer of 1939, the time appeared to have come when Britain could embark upon the destruction of Germany by means of a repetition of a comprehensive policy of encirclement. The plan of the campaign of lies staged for this purpose consisted in declaring that other peoples were threatened, in tricking them with British promises of guarantees and assistance, and of making them take action against Germany just as during the Great War. In this way, Britain, from May to August 1939, succeeded in broadcasting to the world that Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Finland, Bessarabia and also the Ukraine were being directly threatened by Germany. A number of these states allowed themselves to be misled into accepting the promise of a guarantee proffered with these assertions, and thus joining the new encirclement front that is directed against Germany. In these circumstances, I considered myself entitled to assume the responsibility before my own conscience and before the history of the German people, not only of assuring these countries and their governments of the falseness of the British assertions, but also of setting the strongest power in the East at rest as to the limits of our interests by especially solemn declarations. National Socialists, at that time, you probably all felt that it was a bitter and difficult step for me to take. Never did the German people harbour hostile feelings for the peoples of Russia. Yet for over 20 years, the Jewish Bolshevik rulers in Moscow endeavoured to set not only Germany, but the whole of Europe aflame. At no time did Germany attempt to carry her national socialist ideals and conceptions into Russia, yet the Jewish Bolshevik rulers in Moscow unswervingly endeavoured to force their domination upon us and upon other European peoples, not only by ideological means, but above all with military force. The consequences of the activity of this regime were nothing but chaos, misery and starvation in all countries. I, on the other hand, have been striving for 20 years, with a minimum of intervention and without destroying our production, to arrive at a new socialist order in Germany, which would not only eliminate unemployment, but would also permit the workers to receive an ever greater share of the fruits of their own labour. The success of this policy of economic and social reconstruction of our nation, which aims finally at a true people's community by systematically eliminating differences of rank and class, are unique in the entire world. It was, therefore, only with extreme difficulty that I brought myself in August 1939 to send my foreign minister to Moscow in an endeavour there to oppose the British encirclement policy against Germany. I did this only from a sense of responsibility towards the German people, but certainly in the hope, after all, of achieving a permanent détente and of being able to reduce the sacrifices which might otherwise have been demanded of us. While Germany solemnly affirmed in Moscow that the territories and countries mentioned, with the exception of Lithuania, lay beyond all German political interests, a special agreement was concluded in case Britain were to succeed in inciting Poland to actually go to war with Germany. In this case, too, the German claims were subject to a limitation entirely out of proportion to the capabilities of the German forces. National Socialists, the consequences of this treaty, which I myself had desired and which had been concluded in the interests of the German nation, were very severe indeed, particularly for the Germans living in the countries concerned. More than 500,000 German men and women, all of them small farmers, artisans and workmen, were forced to leave their former homeland practically overnight in order to escape from a new regime which from the very first threatened them with boundless misery and, sooner or later, with complete extermination. Nevertheless, thousands of Germans disappeared. It was impossible ever to determine their fate, let alone their whereabouts. Among them were no less than 160 men of German citizenship. To all this, I remained silent, because I was obliged to. For after all, it was my one desire to achieve a final relief of the tension, and, if possible, a permanent settlement with that state. However, even during our advance in Poland, the Soviet rulers suddenly, contrary to the treaty, claimed Lithuania also. The German Reich never had the intention of occupying Lithuania, and not only did not present any such demand to the Lithuanian government, but, on the contrary, even refused the request of the government then in power in Lithuania that German troops should be sent there for that purpose, as inconsistent with the aims of German policy. In spite of all this, I complied with this fresh Russian demand. However, this was only the beginning of continually renewed extortions. The victory in Poland, which was won by German troops alone, caused me to address yet another offer of peace to the Western powers. it was refused, owing to the efforts of the international Jewish warmongers. Even at that time, the reason for such a refusal was to be found in the fact that Britain still had hopes of being able to mobilise a European coalition against Germany, which was to include the Balkans and Soviet Russia. Therefore, the British government decided to send Sir Stafford Cripps as ambassador to Moscow. He received clear instructions that under all circumstances to resume relations between Britain and Soviet Russia and to develop them in a pro-British direction. The British press reported on the progress of this mission so long as tactical reasons did not impose silence upon them. In the autumn of 1939 and in the spring of 1940, the first results actually made themselves felt. When Russia undertook to subjugate by armed force not only Finland but also the Baltic states, she suddenly saw fit to motivate this action by the assertion, which was as ridiculous as it was false, that she had to protect these countries from an outside menace or forestall such an event. This could only be meant to apply to Germany, for no other power could ever gain entrance into the Baltic area, let alone go to war there. But still, I had to be silent. However, those in power in the Kremlin immediately went further. Whereas in the spring of 1940, Germany, in accordance with the so-called Pact of Friendship, had withdrawn her forces a long way from the eastern frontier and had in fact to a great extent cleared those territories entirely of German troops, the concentration of Russian forces at that time was already beginning in a measure which could only be regarded as a deliberate threat to Germany. According to a statement which M. Molotov personally made at that time, there were 22 Russian divisions in the Baltic states alone as early as the spring of 1940. Since the Russian government themselves always maintained that they were called in by the local population, the purpose of their presence in that area could therefore only be a demonstration against Germany. While our soldiers, from 10th of May 1940 onwards, had been breaking the power of France and Britain in the West, the Russian military deployment on our eastern frontier was being continued to a more and more menacing extent. From August 1940 onwards, I therefore considered it to be in the interest of the Reich no longer to permit our eastern provinces, which moreover had already been laid waste so often, to remain unprotected in the face of this tremendous concentration of Bolshevik divisions. Thus, there was produced the effect, which was the object of British and Soviet cooperation, namely, the compulsory maintenance of such powerful German forces in the East, that a radical conclusion of the war in the West, particularly as regards aircraft, could no longer be vouched for by the German High Command. This, however, was in line with the objects not only of British, but also of Soviet-Russian policy, for both Britain and Soviet Russia intend to let this war go on for as long as possible in order to weaken the whole of Europe and render it still more helpless. Russia's threatening attack on Romania was also primarily for the purpose of gaining possession of an important centre, not only of Germany's, but also of Europe's, economic life. Or, alternatively, at least of destroying it. The Reich, especially since 1933, has sought with unending patience to gain the states in the southeast of Europe as trading partners. We therefore had the greatest interest in witnessing their internal constitutional consolidation and organisation. Russia's advance into Romania and Greece's connection with Great Britain threatened to turn these regions too, within a short time, into a general theatre of war. Contrary to our principles and customs, and at the urgent request of the then Romanian government, who were themselves responsible for this development, I advised acquiescence to the Soviet-Russian demands for the sake of peace, intimating that Bessarabia should be ceded. The Romanian government, however, believed that they could not answer for this before their own people, unless Germany and Italy, in compensation, would at least guarantee the integrity of what still remained of Romania. I did so with a heavy heart, principally because if the German Reich gives a guarantee, then that means that it abides by it. We are neither Britons nor are we Jews. I still believed, at this late hour, that I had served the cause of peace in that region, if only by myself assuming a serious obligation. In order, however, finally to solve these problems and to achieve clarity concerning the Russian attitude towards Germany, under the influence also of the continually increasing mobilization on our eastern frontier, I invited M. Molotov to come to Berlin. The Soviet Minister for Foreign Affairs then requested Germany's clarification of our agreement to the following four questions. Number one, Mr. Molotov's question. Was the German guarantee for Romania also directed against Soviet Russia in the case of an attack by Soviet Russia on Romania? And my answer was, the German guarantee is a general one and is unconditionally binding upon us. Russia, however, had declared to us that she had no other interests in Romania beyond Bessarabia. The occupation of northern Bukovina had already been a violation of this assurance. I did not, therefore, think that Russia could now suddenly have more far-reaching intentions against Romania. The next question from Mr. Molotov was, Russia again felt menaced by Finland. Russia was determined not to tolerate this. Was Germany prepared not to give any aid to Finland, and above all, to withdraw the German relief troops marching through to Kirkenes? My answer was that Germany continued to have absolutely no political interest in Finland. A fresh war waged by Russia against a small Finnish people could not, however, be regarded any longer by the German government as tolerable. All the more so, as we could never believe Russia to be threatened by Finland. But we had no desire that another theatre of war should arise in the Baltic. His next question, was Germany prepared to agree that Russia should give a guarantee to Bulgaria and should send Soviet troops to Bulgaria for this purpose? Whereas he, Molotov, wished to state that they did not intend on that account, for example, to depose the king. My answer was that Bulgaria was a sovereign state, and I had no knowledge that Bulgaria had asked Soviet Russia for any kind of guarantee as Romania had asked Germany. Moreover, I would have to discuss this matter with my allies. His last question. Soviet Russia required a free passage through the Dardanelles under all circumstances, and for her protection also demanded the occupation of a number of important bases on the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus. Was Germany in agreement with this or not? My answer. Germany was prepared at all times to agree to an alteration in the Statute of Montreux in favour of the Black Sea states, but Germany was not prepared to agree to Russia's possession of bases on the straits. National Socialists. Here I adopted the only attitude which I could adopt as the responsible leader of the Reich, but also as a conscious representative of European culture and civilization. The consequence was an increase in the Soviet-Russian activity directed against the Reich. Above all, however, the immediate commencement of the undermining of the new Romanian state from within and the attempt to remove the Bulgarian government by propaganda. With the help of confused and immature leaders of the Romanian Legion, a coup d'état was staged in Romania, the aim of which was to overthrow the chief of state, General Antonescu, and to produce chaos in the country so as to remove all legal power of government and thus the sine qua non for the implementing of the German guarantee. I nevertheless still believed it best to remain silent. Immediately after the failure of this undertaking, a renewed reinforcement of the concentrations of Russian troops on Germany's eastern frontier took place. tank units and parachutists were transferred in continually increasing numbers to a dangerous proximity to the German frontier. The German armed forces and the German nation know that until a few weeks ago, not a single German tank or mechanized division was stationed on our eastern frontier. Had any final proof been required for the coalition, which had meanwhile been formed between Great Britain and Soviet Russia, in spite of all diversions and camouflage, then it was provided by the Yugoslav conflict. While I made every effort to undertake a final attempt to pacify the Balkans and, in close cooperation with El Duce, invited Yugoslavia to join the Tripartite Pact, Britain and the Soviet Union, in joint conspiracy, organised that coup d'etat, which removed in one night the government of the time, who had been ready to come to an agreement. For we can today inform the German nation that the Serbian push against Germany did not take place merely under British, but primarily under Soviet-Russian auspices. As we remain silent on this matter also, the Soviet leaders now went still one step further. They not only organised the push, but a few days later also concluded that well-known friendly agreement with their new subservient vassals, which was intended to strengthen the Serbs in their desire to resist the pacification of the Balkans and to incite them against Germany, and this was no platonic intention. Moscow demanded the mobilisation of the Serbian army. Since even now, I still believed it to be better not to speak, those in power in the Kremlin went still another step further. The government of the German Reich today possessed documentary evidence which proves that Russia, in order to finally bring Serbia into the war against Germany, gave her a promise to supply her, via Salonika, with arms, aircraft, munitions and other war material. And this happened almost at the very moment when I myself advised the Japanese Foreign Minister, Dr. Matsuoka, to ease the tension with Russia, hoping, as I did thusly, to serve the cause of peace. Only the rapid advance of our incomparable divisions to Skopje, as well as the capture of Salonika itself, frustrated the aims of this Soviet-Russian-Anglo-Saxon plot. The officers of the Serbian Air Force, however, fled to Russia and were there immediately received as allies. It was the victory of the Axis powers in the Balkans alone which in the first instance thwarted the plan to involve Germany in fighting in southeastern Europe, lasting for months throughout the summer, while in the meantime steadily completing the concentration of the Soviet-Russian armies and increasing their readiness for war, in order, finally, together with Britain and supported by the American supplies anticipated, to throttle and crush the German Reich and Italy. Thus Moscow not only broke, but miserably betrayed the stipulations of our friendly agreement. All this was done while the rulers in the Kremlin, exactly as they had done in the case of Finland and Romania, up to the very last moment put up a show of peace and friendship and drew up ostensibly innocent dementis. Although up till now, I have been forced by circumstances to keep silent again and again, the moment has now come when to continue as a mere observer would not only be a sin of omission, but a crime against the German people and even against the whole of Europe. Today, something like 160 Russian divisions are facing our frontiers. For weeks, constant violations of this frontier have been taking place, not only into our country, but from the far north down to Romania. Russian airmen consider it a sport simply and nonchalantly to overlook these frontiers, presumably in order to prove to us that they already feel themselves masters of these territories. In the night from the 17th to the 18th of June, Russian reconnaissance parties again penetrated into Reich territory and could only be driven back after prolonged firing. This has brought us to the hour when it is necessary for us to take steps against this plot devised by Jewish Anglo-Saxon warmongers and the equally Jewish rulers of the Bolshevik headquarters in Moscow. German people, at this very hour, a movement of troops is taking place, which in its extent and magnitude is the greatest that the world has ever seen. United with their Finnish comrades, the soldiers who gained the victory at Narvik are manning the shores of the Arctic Ocean. German divisions, commanded by the conqueror of Norway, together with the champions of Finnish liberty, commanded by their marshal, are protecting Finnish territory. From East Prussia down to the Carpathians, there stretch the formations of the German Eastern Front. Along the shores of the Pruth, along the lower reaches of the Danube, down to the shores of the Black Sea, German and Romanian soldiers are united under the Romanian Chief of State, General Antonescu. The task of this front is thus no longer the protection of individual countries, but the safety of Europe and the salvation of us all. I have therefore decided today to entrust the fate and the future of the German Reich and of our people once more to the hands of our soldiers. May the Lord our God aid us in this struggle of all struggles.
You've tuned in to Radio Stormer at the Daily Storm.